said Welts and the robber barons, straight to hell, the greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Okay, alternative visions. As we've done in the past, we turn our focus to what's happening with the U.S. labor movement, and particularly the union side of that labor movement. And today we're going to talk about what might be an important development, and that has to do with the negotiations still in progress. Between United Auto Workers and Chrysler Fiat Corporation. Recently, negotiations had gotten to a point where the union negotiators, this is at a national level, so we're talking about the national leadership of the UAW, had put to a vote the proposal, the last best offer of the company, which was pretty poor. And they put it to the members, and the members voted it down overwhelmingly. This hasn't happened too often recently in union history here, recent history, where the rank and file, the membership, dramatically refuse to accept the offer recommended by the union leaders. Is this a harbinger of things to come? In any event, it was back to the bargaining table, and the union leadership, the new president of the UAW here, who has been heading up these negotiations, Dennis Williams, went back to the bargaining table, and apparently they got another new proposal. Is it much better? Is it significantly better than the old one? We don't know. It's going to be put to another vote of the members. And what we're going to talk about today is that topic. What is the significance of this negotiations? Is it just a local thing in the UAW and the auto industry? What does it portend for the UAW itself? You know, once a great union with over 2 million members has shrunk tremendously, particularly in the last decade and a half since 2000, as most of manufacturing has in this country. You know, we used to have 18.5 million people in manufacturing as recently as 2000. Today, we have 12 million, 6 million less than we had back then, and still less than we had in 2007. When the crisis began and the Great Recession began. So you hear all this talk about, oh, manufacturing and autos and so forth are coming back. Oh, so great. Yeah, we're still 1.5 million less than we were before the latest crisis. So there's still a crisis in manufacturing, and in autos, of course, lost a lot of members in autos. And wages have not done very well in autos. Largely because ever since 2007, especially, auto companies have been hiring two-tier, lower-paid, no-benefits kind of workers. All the new hires, making less than $20 an hour, almost a true minimum wage, and far less of benefits. Two classes of citizens in the auto industry. In the unions themselves, and these are the massive concessions that the union has made to the employers. And the employers, by the way, the auto companies are making record profits globally and even in the U.S., record sales, record profits, and workers are still, many of them, making half pay. Well, a lot of those profits are because of the half pay. And do we have a movement here to try to end this half-pay, two-tier arrangement, and will it succeed, and how significant is it, if it does succeed, for a shift in the U.S. labor movement to end this two-tier, two-class of citizens arrangement. Okay, my guest is Greg Shotwell, who was a former rank-and-file member for decades of the United Auto Workers, have been very active in the past in various reform movements within the UAW. Recently retired, but still very active. No one really knows the UAW better and has thought more about its strategy than Greg Shotwell. I hope he is on. Yes. Greg, are you there?
Yes, I am, Jack. Thank
oh,
you.
Wonderful, wonderful. Didn't hear the click, so I wasn't sure whether you were on. But we're really fortunate to have Greg because if there's anybody who can give us a reasoned, intelligent, inside view of what's going on in the UAW and these negotiations, it's really Greg. And Greg, thanks for taking your time out and coming and joining us here about this. You know, we want to discuss really what's going on, so listeners can know what the issues are, what the sort of status of negotiations is. But you know, even broader than that, we'll have the whole show to talk about it. You know, what's the significance of this negotiations, if there is, for the future of the UAW? Is it a turning point, or is it more of the same? And, of course, then for the labor movement as a whole in the U.S., which is barely hanging on nowadays under this double attack or multiple attack from the corporations for the last decade or so, which has been aided and abetted by politicians all along the way. Can labor really come back is a important question here. Come back meaning to its prior level of influence and contribution to American society, which was very significant. You know, we talk about the lack of consumption going, and that's one reason why this recovery since 2009 has been so poor. We're just not getting consumption going. And even, you know, the big policymakers in government and business recognize the lack of wage gains is really the cause of this. And while they talk about let's raise the minimum wage, which is good, you know, we're all for that. That's just a small part of the total workforce. And one of the reasons why we have this problem with wage growth, which isn't, and consumption, and therefore economic recovery, is that the unions have been decimated. We no longer have this factor during a recovery period. The unions negotiate the wage increases, and even though there's a lag, workers catch up a little bit after the crisis. Well, there's been no catch-up after the crisis because the unions now, after this great recession, are just a shell in many cases of what they once were. Of course, the politicians and the business folks have for 30 years, you know, consciously planned the decimation, and they've succeeded in that. You know, what does it take to resurrect American unions? Well, just as a last comment on that, you know, I'm writing a book on that based on my own experience and 40 years of looking at and being in the unions at various levels as, you know, an organizer, as a member, as a negotiator, and so forth. Got my own ideas, and I'll be forthcoming early next year with a book on that, with specific ideas of what reforms are necessary. Anyway, enough of my own plans here. We really want to return after that unnecessary, probably, digression and talk with Greg here. Greg, let me throw the question out to you. First of all, bring us up to date on what are the issues here and how important is this negotiation for the UAW?
Thanks, Jack, for having me on. And first, I'd like to say before we get into issues unique to the UAW and the auto industry is that I believe this struggle with Chrysler, Fiat Chrysler, and the UAW resonates with workers who are non-union, who are in other industries, service industries, and even professionals, teachers and nurses, because what's happening to United Auto Workers is happening right across the board. And it hasn't merely been since 2007, although the intensity increased then. But for the last dozen years, workers have been on the skids. And there's, you know, as you said, there's this generation of workers who are treated like second-class citizens, and it's not according to gender or race or ethnicity or immigration. It's every new hire is treated as a second-class citizen, but some of these new hires are 50 years old because they've had to move into a different line of work. So what's happening there at the United Auto Workers, I think, is going to resonate with workers all over, and it is a harbinger. If the UAW cannot succeed at rectifying, then who can? Now, the companies are, as you said, you know, they're making record profits. And in the meantime, workers haven't had raises at all since 2005. And they've lost the cost of living adjustment. So that means that's 10 years without a raise if you're top tier. Now, if you're one of the new hires, you're not only making half as much as top tier, but you don't have the same benefits. You don't have a pension plan. You don't have health care and retirement. So they're not just making half the hourly wage, but they're not even making half as much in benefits. You know, their future is work till you die or go out on Social Security disability. That's not much of a future to look forward to.
What now, percent of the workforce at Chrysler or in the big three would you say now are the second class citizens making half pay? What percent, roughly? You have any idea what that is?
Yeah, well, it's different at each automaker. So, like right now at Chrysler, it's about 45%. I don't know off the top of my head. I think General Motors and Ford are under 20%, more about 20%, because they had a cap that they couldn't hire more than that. At Chrysler, they allowed them to hire more. But the issue came forward then in this new contract that the main issue that workers wanted was equal pay for equal work and overtime after 8 hours. I mean, the 8-hour day goes back to Haymarket. For God's sakes, you know, we were fighting for the 8-hour day back in the 1880s, and here we are in 2015 fighting for the 8-hour day again because workers are working more than 8 hours in a day and not getting time and a half. Now, when they came back with this new contract, one of the big difficulties was that, first of all, the workers were not going to get equal pay. They were going to get raises, but they weren't going to equalize the pay, which is a standard union principle. But they had promised 4 years ago that they would cap the amount of new hires. In other words, they said in a letter written by Bob King and the late UAW Vice President at Chrysler, General Holifield, a letter on the front page of the highlights, which is what they used to inform members about the contract, they promised that in 2015 they would cap new hires or second-tier workers at 25%, which meant that people presently working on the lower tier would have the opportunity to grow into that top tier wage, and they were looking forward to that. Well, when the contract came out,
that would be about 20%. If you said there's 45% of Chrysler, about 25%.
So we're talking maybe 8,000 people. You know, think, well, I'm going to get this raise. Well, when it came out, the vice president Norma Jewell said, "Oh, that was a typo." they didn't really mean that. And so he publicly admitted that whatever he says at a contract information meeting and whatever the UAW presents in a highlight is not to be trusted. You know, this was an enormous admission. I was really shocked that they would do that.
Let me ask you a question here. This is fascinating. You said they had agreed in 2015, correct me if I'm wrong, that 20% of the 45% who were second tier here would automatically get on the track to be full paid, but then they reneged on that. But wasn't that in writing? Didn't the union get that in writing?
Well, here's what happened. They had made this promise in 2011 that in 2015, 4 years later, the new contract would cap the number of new hires. But it wasn't in the contract. It was in a letter that was signed by the president and the vice president and given to the UAW members. And the highlights are kind of a summary of the contract. So it wasn't actually in the contract. But that's neither here nor there because it's a four-year contract. You can't promise something that's going to happen after the contract expires, which is the problem with the new contract. So what happened was, when this happened, it just blew up in their faces, and UAW members voted the first contract down 2-1. They said, no way are we going to settle for that. So
the UAW turns around, right?
And comes back with a contract that says, okay, we're going to give you equal pay in 8 years. Well, you know, you just told us we couldn't trust a promise made. That's not in the contract. How can a four-year contract guarantee a payment in 8 years? It can't. You don't have to be a legal scholar to understand that. And auto workers have had too many experiences where an automaker, a corporation, will promise investments and promise to jobs and then change their minds, even though it is in a contract. So this isn't flying very well with the members. On top of that, like I say, the big problem was they didn't like having different tiers of workers. You know, a union's about equality and solidarity. And this new contract actually creates more different tiers.
Explain that, Greg. How does it do that?
It depends on where you work and when you were hired and probably who you're related to, because all those things depend on that. Plus, the Mopar division, which makes parts, and the Axle division. So different parts of the Fiat Chrysler Automobile Corporation will have different wage structures. And they're quite a bit different. There's a $5 difference. But, you know, the other thing is, if I have to wait 8 years to get that top-tier wage and I don't have cost-of-living adjustment, then that installment plan is going to be more like a wage cut than a raise, because after 8 years, the cost of living is going to have gone up, but I will not have kept up with the cost of living. See, the whole point is these people deserve reparations. They've been making sacrifices since 2005. We gave up COLA in 2005. We gave up raises in 2005. That's 10 years ago. And now they want people to wait another 8 years when the companies are enormously profitable and when, you know, the Center for Automotive Research has said that that salaried workers have been making, I'm going to look for this quote, 50% more than hourly workers. It says here, since 2009 in the U.S., management compensation has grown about 50% faster than union workers. In the U.S. auto industry, real wages have declined 24% since 2003. So salaried workers are getting reparations. They're being reimbursed for the sacrifices that they made. The investing class is enjoying an enormous recovery. They're bragging about the hordes of cash they're sitting on. But workers are on the skids. And it's appalling that the UAW would turn around and come back to these people and say, well, just wait for another 8 more years.
Why so the UAW leadership initially agreed in the first contract proposal that was voted down, 2-1. It initially agreed and recommended the workers should accept this 8-year delay?
No, in the initial one, they didn't have the 8-year delay. What they had is a 4-year contract, and they promised some workers would get to go up, but they would not cap the second tier workers. And so Chrysler would be allowed to hire more of the lower tiered workers, the lesser paid workers, than before. It was really shocking. Now they were going to give them raises, but considering that the huge wage cut they took in the beginning, but also that we haven't had cost of living for 10 years. The cost of living goes up, 2.5% every year. So what have they lost? Well, the automotive, they said, Center for Automotive Research said that wages have gone down 24% since 2003. They haven't gained. That's how much they've lost. There just haven't been any raises. And then another conservative business columnist, Daniel House for the Detroit News, reported and quoted again, the Center for Automotive Research estimates that UAW labor accounts for 8% of Ford's total cost, 6-7% at GM, and just 4% at Fiat Chrysler.
So wow, that's all, huh?
That's almost insignificant. They don't want to look at executive pay and the salaried pay, and they don't ever report the expense accounts that these people receive. But they look at one of the smallest pieces of the pie and say, you guys have to wait. You're going to have to. And if this is happening in auto, I can't imagine that it's any better anywhere else. I can't imagine non-union workers are doing better. I can't imagine, I have no teachers and nurses and other people who are experiencing the same thing. Their work has intensified. They may not take a wage cut, but every time people retire, they don't replace them. They just add more work.
Oh, I can speak personally here. My wife is a high school teacher, and what they're having them do is more and more of the teachers, more and more of the management tasks that administrators used to do, but with no more pay. So they're staying longer hours, doing all the extra work after school, and then, of course, they got to do all the grading at night. I mean, the teachers are working like 12 hours a day without any more pay. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. And
that's typical.
The excuse that I call it the concession caucus. It's the administrative caucus of the UAW, but they've really turned into the concession caucus. Their excuse is that the pie is only so big, and if we take too big of a piece of pie, that Fiat or GM or whoever won't invest in the United States, some move abroad. But
at 4%, your piece of the pie is at 4%. Your piece of the pie is too big, huh?
Right. Well, but just focusing on Chrysler for a minute. I'm looking at an article in Bloomberg News. This is 2014, and it says that Sergio Marchionne's plan to invest in Italian factories, quote, depends on access to Chrysler's $12 billion cash hoard. So he's relying on the profits in the United States at Chrysler. We're talking about, Jeep and the Ram pickup and the Caravan. The profits here to invest in Italy, because Europe is lagging behind, because their market isn't so good, and Fiat, is suffering themselves. Now, in 2009, again, I'm looking at this article from Bloomberg, and, I recall this, when Fiat came in to rescue Chrysler, they didn't put any money down.
Oh, that's interesting.
Part of the government and labor union bailout was that rather than paying for cash, this is a quote, rather than paying cash for initial 20% holding and subsequent 50% take, Fiat provided management experience and technology and helped Chrysler meet various performance milestones, such as developing models. Well, workers have been providing their expertise and their know-how and their grit and their muscle. Why aren't they getting rewarded? They put as much in as anybody, and I would say more.
That's the old story of this recovery, you know. The government and the central bank bails out the banks and big businesses. Well, you know, the auto companies got $80 billion from the government. At the same time, while they get the money, as you say, the workers are giving up more and more. So it's, you know, it's not bailing out the... is bailing out the stockholders and the management. It's not really bailing out, quote, the companies, which include the workers. You're right.
In 2014, Fiat had to buy out the UAW VEBA. Now, the VEBA is a benefit trust for health care for retirees. Now, as part of the bailout, the VEBA trust was given a 41.5% stake in the new company, Fiat Chrysler. So they owned that much stock in Chrysler. Now, of course, you know, Fiat wanted to buy that out and be the majority holder.
So what you're telling me is
this is from
Bloomberg.
The quote says most of the money was put up by Chrysler, not Fiat. And quote, this is, you know, Vincenzo Longo, a strategist at IG Group in Milan, said by phone, Fiat couldn't get a better deal. They didn't even pay for it. Chrysler paid for it. So who's paying for the bailout is the workers. And now, when Chrysler's making record profits, when Chrysler's vehicles are hot right now in the market, who is going to get rewarded? They're telling workers to wait 8 years?
Well, explain for the listeners what VEBA is a little bit more. I know what it is, but VEBA is a trust, a healthcare trust fund, correct?
Mm-hmm.
That is really owned by the union, right? Indirectly.
Well, you know, VEBAs, if we go back a little bit, you know, VEBAs have existed for a long time. VEBA stands for Voluntary Employee Benefit Association. And when a company agrees to pay benefits, health benefits for its employees and its retirees, it sets up like an escrow fund, a trust, where it puts money in to pay as they go for employees and also for retirees. But VEBAs were never regulated by the government. They weren't regulated like ERISA regulates the pensions, you know, and guarantees that pensions will be funded at a certain level and so forth. And there isn't a pension benefit guarantee behind VEBAs. So VEBAs have existed for a long time. And, you know, back in 2005, I recall General Motors bragging that it had $20 billion in its VEBA. But that seemed to have disappeared when they decided to go bankrupt. You know, who knows where it went. Who knows if it ever existed. But in 2005, they began the first VEBA, and in 2007, they solidified that. And what they did was the companies, GM, Ford, and Chrysler, all contributed to a trust fund for retirees' health care. Now, what they contributed was really about half the projected value, or the half the projected liability. But it was a way for them to get it off their books so that they would look better. It was a way for the UAW to have more influence politically with workers, with retirees. It also guaranteed a lot of patronage jobs, a lot of nepotism involved in that, I'm sure. So now what we have is the UAW, it's not like they own it. It's a trust fund, but some of their UAW officials are on the board along with other appointed trustees, and they administer health care for retirees.
Greg, is this a trust fund for combined for all the auto companies or just Chrysler? Or do each have their own trust fund?
Each auto company has its own VEBA.
Okay.
At this point, our original problem with that was that most of what the companies put into the VEBA was stock, which created a conflict of interest in the UAW, because if the UAW is bargaining with the company at the same time that they own stock in the company, and that with that stock they're responsible to the retirees, how are they supposed to manage that objectively? How are they supposed to fight as hard as they can for the guy on the floor? And what happened? And at the same time, we got two-tier. We got a new generation of workers who come in at half the rate of pay, no pension, and no health care in retirement. So we see this.
So they don't benefit from VEBA at all. They don't get anything out of VEBA.
Pardon me?
The new hires, they don't.
No.
You know, the second class citizens on the floor, they don't get anything out of VEBA at all.
Correct. You know, okay. What they've got is the company donates like a dollar an hour into a fund that they'll get when they retire. So that would be, you know, what are we talking about in a year, 1,800 hours, maybe $2,000 a year? What's that going to mean in 30 years? What's that going to do? You know, that wouldn't buy you a health plan today. You know, not for a family. It wouldn't suffice today. It's not going to mean anything at all in the future. And they're not. They're not in the VEBA, which creates another conflict of interest because, you know, I grew up in a union that honored its retirees because of what they sacrificed for me. You know, I came into the union making top-tier wages and having a pension and having COLA, and I owed that to the retirees. So whenever there was a contract, we wanted the retirees to be rewarded, and we wanted to respect them. Well, the next generation doesn't have that bond. The solidarity has been broken.
Between the generations, I see.
Between
sure.
the generations, exactly. Yeah. I mean, they might have a lot, you know, a lot of them are children of former auto workers, but let's face it, you know, I'm embarrassed. I'm ashamed that my generation stabbed them in the back. You know, we went out the door and said, you know, when I came into the union, I got this full platter of food. It had meat and potatoes and vegetables and dessert. And I turned around, and not only was that meal depleted, I gave them a broken plate. I gave them half the wages and no future. I'm embarrassed. It's terrible. And that we need to rectify that. Now, this new concession caucus, Dennis Williams and Norwood Jewell, after that first contract was rejected so soundly, I mean, 2-1, they were embarrassed.
This was only a few weeks ago, right?
Right. It was just a couple weeks ago. So what did they do? They blamed social media. They figure it must be Facebook's fault. You know, people are talking to each other too much. You know, that's the problem. So what? You know what they did? They hired.
They hired a public relations firm.
Yeah, and this was in the Detroit Free Press. They turned to Berlin Rose and a public relations firm that was involved with the Detroit City bankruptcy and New York Mayor Bill de Blasio's election to, quote, help the union communicate its message with the workers. Now, this is like saying UAW members pay UAW representatives to pay someone else to represent the UAW representatives to the UAW members. Why do they need somebody else to interpret the contract they just negotiated?
That's amazing, yes.
And where's the money coming from? Where does the money come from to pay? And you know, the international has a public relations department. They don't usually answer calls, but they do have one. People are paid to do this.
How much are they paying this PR firm?
Does this come out of?
Pardon me? How much are they paying the PR firm, Greg? Do you know?
No, they're not telling us that.
Ah,
you know, that will show up. That might show up on the books next year, but you know, these things can be buried in accounts. It's not always so easy to find, and it might be coming out of joint funds. You know, joint funds are where the company and the union, well, the union doesn't donate anything to joint funds, but the company pays the union to represent their interest and to run company programs. So it's another conflict of interest. This could be coming out of joint funds because, really, the PR firm is selling the contract for Chrysler. You know, Chrysler wants this deal, and this is great to promise people that, you know, a 4-year contract, you're going to get the raise you wanted in 8 years. It's just preposterous.
Can you summarize for our listeners what are the two, three, whatever main issues in this first contract that got voted down 2-1? What are the main issues, as you understand
okay,
them?
Okay, the main issues was really that they wanted equal pay for equal work. They wanted everybody to come up to the same tier wage. Everybody should make top-tier wages. And the top-tier workers haven't had a raise since 2005. They wanted a raise. So, you know, indeed, you know, people might look at that and say, oh, that's a whole lot all at once. Well, it's not if you'll stop to reflect that they've been working below standards for 10 years. Salaried workers got raises. Executives got raises. Investors have been reaping the profits, and they haven't. So they wanted the reparations. They want to get what they deserve. Now, so that was a big one. Another one was that they haven't had cost of living since 2005. They wanted cost of living. A big one was alternative work schedules. Now, what this is time and a half for anything over 8 hours. The alternative work schedules, what it amounts to is you work 12 hours, but you get paid straight time. So they juggle the hours in a way where you're going to work 40 hours, but you're going to work 12-hour days, or you're going to work Sunday or Saturday, but you don't get the overtime pay.
Right, and by law, unions can negotiate, for the listeners here, these exceptions to the law that says over 8 hours a day has to be time and a half in most states, right? So
right,
if you negotiate this 12, it sounds like 12 and 6, huh? Or 12 and 4, 3.5 days at 12 hours plus?
Well, you know,
or is it 4 days
it was
at
not,
12?
It was not only that you would have, you might work four-tens.
Four-tenths,
you know,
okay.
But, you know, so the schedules, they were very unstable and inconsistent. And in some situations, workers would have to work days 1 week and nights the next week.
Oh,
which
yeah, okay.
Physically and psychologically unhealthy.
Killer.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a
and
killer.
I'm surprised that management would even want to do that to people, except when you do that to a worker, then the company dominates their whole life. Their outside social relationships are difficult to maintain. You can't join the softball league because they play every week, not every other week, and they don't switch from days to nights. You can't take classes because classes are consistent. They don't flip-flop back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
Your family life is deeply disturbed. So, you know, they wanted to go back to the 8-hour day. There was also a major thing was, and to come back to the new contract, the alternative work schedule. You know what they said? We'll negotiate that after the contract, after you ratify.
Well, you got
why
no
should
bargaining
anybody
power.
Believe them, you know, that it would be a good deal? And then the other thing was health care. Now, you know, you understand about the Cadillac health care tax.
Yep.
That with this new Affordable Health Care Act, people that have good health care, the company is going to pay an additional tax on top of it. So they were looking for ways to offset that. Well, the easiest way to offset it is to shift the cost to the patient or to the worker. So, and that could be through premiums, co-pays, deductibles. Now, the UAW came out and said, you know what, we're going to form a health care co-op with all of the automakers. And it will be kind of like, you know, the VEBA, where everybody's lumped in together. And what they were proposing is a discount of scale. You know, if you have that big of a group, that you would be able to get a better deal. Well, they couldn't explain it because it's not explainable. They couldn't condense it into something that they could sell to anybody. And as you probably are aware, in the United States, healthcare delivery systems are regional. In other words, because I live in Southwest Michigan, what is available to me for health insurance is different from people in Southeast Michigan, just a couple hours away. You know, I don't have the same access to the same doctors and hospitals, and we can't all negotiate together. people on the east side of the state have, maybe they have an HMO, but I don't on my side of the state. So the whole co-op, you know, just sounded to people like another deal that there was no way that they were going to understand, except that there was going to be cost shifting and they were going to have to pay more out of pocket. All right. If I got to pay more out of pocket, then I need to make more money. And not in 8 years. I need it this year.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was the other thing with second tier, is that they have different, you know, health care for the employees. Another thing that bothers them is, you know, break time has been reduced. You know,
From what?
Work has intensified over the years, and this isn't just true in the auto industry. It's true for teachers. It's true for nurses. It's true for office workers. Everybody has seen an intensification of work. Computers and automation have not made our lives easier. They've made them more frantic, more hectic, and people are working longer hours. Now, people on the line are working longer, they're working harder, and they're working for less. So those were the big items the first time. And none of these things were really resolved in the second contract. They kind of shuffled the deck and dealt a new hand that looked just like the old hand, except you were going to wait 8 years. And, you know, some people would benefit. Now, some people would benefit more than others. So this wasn't, again, this is something the UAW has adopted recently. Instead of a collective bargaining agreement, they negotiate selective bargaining agreements. It's good for some, it's not so good for others, and it's terrible for some. You know, we used to have an agreement where everybody went together. You know, a victory for one was a victory for all. An injury for one was an injury for all. Now, everybody looks at this contract, they sit down at the kitchen table and say, how does it work for me?
Mm-hmm.
That's not union.
Yeah, and the negotiators are counting votes, you know. Maybe we throw a little sweetener in with that group, we'll get a couple more votes here, you know. They're just trying to get 50% plus one or whatever it is to sell the thing. Now, you mentioned, well, first of all, my first impression of this list that you gave me is, wow, these are massive issues. And it's really hard to see by just shuffling them around that people are going to buy a reshuffled deck here. I mean, this top-tier equality, that would have essentially eliminated the two-tier idea after 4 years. Is that correct?
Well...
Or no? Or
yeah,
partly?
The new contract wouldn't even bring everybody up to the top-tier wage after 8 years. They would be close, but, you know, they wouldn't get the brass ring. So
okay.
they didn't even get that after 8.
That was in the first proposal.
No,
this
is in the second one. In the first one, there was not a progression. There was not a path to equality. Now, the Canadians had negotiated a second-tier wage, but their initial second-tier wage had a 10-year grow-in. In other words, every year you would get a raise until you got to the top tier. Now, that's hard to swallow, but they got it from the beginning. They understood that they were going to work up to it. The UAW, everybody looks at 2007 and the big three Detroit automakers as the turning point. But this two-tier, the second-class citizenship for workers began a long time ago. It just didn't happen to the elite. You know, mm-hmm. It started in the parts industry. It started in the construction industry. It started, you know, all over the world for a lot of workers. But it really drew attention when it came to the United Auto Workers in the Big Three in 2007. Mm-hmm. That's when it, you know... They said, wow, if they can do it there. And that's when I recognized that this isn't a recession. This is a restructuring. All workers are going to be paid less.
Yes, that's been going on for some time. Yes, you're absolutely right about that. And, you know, elsewhere in the world, what they call it is labor market reform. They're pushing it in Europe, they're pushing it in Japan, they're pushing it everywhere. And that's to create a U.S.-like restructuring of labor relations to drive wages down, to weaken unions, to eliminate collective bargaining, and pretty much to destroy any organization, economic organization of working classes everywhere. This is going on everywhere, not just in the U.S. The rest are trying to catch up with the U.S. The U.S. pioneered this, as you said, in the last 15 years, and there were pilots before that, pilot programs, but boy, they've really been pushing it, and at the heart is this two-tier thing, and get rid of COLAs, get rid of health care. That's what Obama's ACA is all about, privatized health care, and that's what this Cadillac tax is coming in 2018. That will be the end of union employer-negotiated health care, and you know, privatize everything, and you know, give everybody jobs without security and without guaranteed hours and without guaranteed pay, and you know, you broke the back here of any resistance, and that's been going on, and it's intensifying, and that's the reality of relationships here, and you know, the union leadership, I'm sorry to say, has not either realize the strategic depth of this whole thing, or they do, and they're just going along with it. Anyway, that's my rant on this. But tell me now, what's the difference for the listeners in this second proposal that's now supposedly on the table that the PR firm's going to try to slickly sell to the membership? What is different? You gave us a good picture of all the incredible crap in this first one. Oh, you know, overtime and health care and no COLAs and no real equality and, you know, no health insurance, really improvements and schedules, horrendous. It's like working at, sounds like you're working at Walmart, you know, in terms of scheduling and pay and everything, the Walmartization of the auto industry, all right? But tell us what's in this latest. Is there any real improvement here? I mean, you read in the press, and Dennis Williams and the UAW leadership is really pumping this up, you know, and you get reports that everyone clapped, you know, at the meeting that this was such a big improvement. What's improved?
Well, you know, what they're trying to brag about is that there will be raises and there will be profit sharing. And so, that, you know, they like to lump all this together and make it sound like there's going to be a huge profit for the workers over this extended period of time. And that math works if you don't include all the other numbers. You know, it's one thing to add up. If you take inventory, say you have a company and you go into the warehouse and you take inventory, or you're looking at your books and you add up all your assets. Well, that's going to look good. But if you don't look at your liabilities, is that accurate? So if we compare the raises but we don't understand that they don't have a cost of living, then those raises are going to be diminished every year. And the cost, you know, the profits are based on a formula that, well, you can't really count on it. Sometimes it's good, you know. Sometimes it isn't, but
I'll just interject here on profits
and share the profit.
The profits in this industry have peaked. From my research, they've peaked, and you're not going to see the kind of growth in profits in the auto industry in the next 5 years. It's going to be much less, and I don't know if. People have been looking at this PPP agreement.
What's different about profit sharing and cost of living is that a cost of living in your raise compounds and accrues year after year after year. And everything, you know, your Social Security, all your benefits are based on that base wage. So if I have cost of living, and this is what made the big difference for auto workers. And, you know, when I was coming up, we went through the 80s when inflation went right through the roof. But my wages went right up with it. So that made a huge disparity between automobile workers and non-union workers. Non-union workers took a wage cut, but they couldn't see who gave them the wage cut because it didn't have the boss's face on it. It was inflation. See, they may have gotten a raise, but they did not keep up with the cost of living. Whereas in the United Auto Workers, you know, every time gas went up, my wages went up. Mm-hmm. So we didn't suffer.
Now
you get a profit-sharing check, and it's gone with the wind. You know, what I'm going to do with a profit-sharing check is pay off my bills because I'm not making enough money to live on. A young person today making half the wages that I used to make, half the wages, and he's trying to buy a car, support a family, invest in a house. He doesn't have money to save. He doesn't have money to set aside for his retirement. He can't. In fact, most people are having to decide, do I want a car or do I want an apartment, because I can't afford both. Everybody's moving in with their parents.
Mm-hmm. This raise in the second proposal, is this a lump sum payment, or is it in the wage schedules? To what extent does it eliminate this two-tier thing? Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, well, you know, some people get a raise and some people don't. So the top-tier workers will get a raise 1 year and not the next year, and then the next year they get a raise but not the next year. And the second-tier workers are promised raises, you know, over the course of 8 years, but they're all treated differently depending on where they work and, you know, how long they've been there. So it's kind of hard for me to explain to a general listener all these disparities. And that's not a union contract. Now, again, the union says, look, we can't negotiate good contracts because we're in competition with non-union plants, and we need to organize. Well, damn right, we need to organize. But the way to attract new workers into unions is with good contracts. Why should a VW worker in Chattanooga, Tennessee, want to join the UAW when the biggest problem that they have down there that I've heard is the alternative work schedule? They don't like having to shift from days to nights. But if they go to UAW, they're not going to solve that problem. Mm-hmm. If they go to the UAW, what they see is people getting lower wages, people getting, you know, divided into tiers. The other thing they don't like is temporary workers. They don't like working next to a temp because that's their neighbor. That's their family. That's their friend. They don't like the way these temporaries are mistreated. But in the UAW, this new contract doubles the amount of people that that Chrysler and Fiat can hire for temporary.
Oh, really? Explain that.
I can't explain that, but that's what it said. You know,
gives them the right to hire even more temps, this proposal on the table?
Yeah, they didn't put that in the highlights thing. You know, I'm sure the PR firm torpedoed that one, but Automotive News discovered it in around page 250 of the actual contract. So it was one of those things they just wanted to bury. But it was one of the ways that, you know, okay, we're going to give these people a raise, but we're going to give them a raise based on we're going to take it out of these other workers. So workers are making all the sacrifices. Workers are making all the payments. Just, you know, this is, you know, Fiat came in and bought Chrysler for nothing. They bought Chrysler for their management expertise. Well, what about the expertise of workers?
Mm-hmm.
Now, how come workers don't get that kind of reward?
So in this latest proposal...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
In this latest proposal, there's no addressing of these shifting work schedules or regular overtime pay or the Cadillac tax, huh?
It says they'll meet in 60 days to discuss other alternative work schedules. After the contract is ratified, they'll meet. They quit talking about the healthcare co-op because they didn't know what they were talking about. They couldn't explain it. I mean, if you can't explain, if I go in to buy a car and I ask the salesman a question and he can't explain it, well, I'm not going to buy. If I can't look under the hood, I'm not going to buy. So, you know, they just took that off the table. But they said, you know what, we're not going to have higher premiums. Don't worry. Well, that doesn't mean you won't have higher deductibles. That doesn't mean you won't have higher copays. There's no promise there. And there's also the job security issue. The company says they're going to invest, but that doesn't guarantee jobs. They could invest in equipment that eliminates jobs.
Right.
And that
right.
doesn't mean anything. And in too many years, United Auto Workers have seen the company make promises that were vacuous. They never backed them up. Never. And the UAW didn't force them to, probably because they weren't there to begin with. You know, it was a PR stunt. Now we're going to invest. You know, there's going to be new products. Well, we know, I mean, you know, they've already said they're moving work to Mexico.
Yeah, well, talking about moving work here, I don't know whether it's come into the negotiations. I suspect not, but now we're getting leaks on this Trans-Pacific Partnership thing that I've been writing and talking about, and it looks like there's some really onerous provisions there affecting auto workers. It looks like the U.S. negotiators have agreed to allow more Japanese auto imports, which means these imports will be made by Japanese factories in China at very low cost into the U.S. And another provision is going to allow U.S. companies to produce more autos and trucks in Southeast Asia. So a lot of that auto production is going to move offshore. For the trucks and the auto parts, which, as you know, have almost disappeared in the U.S. Delphi had 100,000 workers in the U.S. Now it has 100,000 in Mexico. That's going to get whacked even further.
Right. Yeah.
So I don't know whether they're even admitting that.
Never work in our favor. But, you know, we have lost, you know, tremendous amount of manufacturing in the United States. I read a book a few years ago called Punching Out, and the guy was a journalist, was observing a factory in Detroit being torn apart and shipped overseas. And he was saying, you know, the people tearing this factory down and taking the machinery apart and packing it up and shipping it overseas are making more money than a new hire at General Motors. And it's like that's where our future is. Demolition,
well, I'll give you the exact numbers. In 2000, there were 18.8 million workers in manufacturing. Today, there are 12.3. So we lost 6.5.
Yes.
And we are still down 1.5 million from 2007. Mm-hmm. And most of those, by the way, are auto jobs. So, yeah, we've lost almost 7 million jobs that haven't been recovered in the United States. And it's not only that we lost 7 million jobs. American manufacturing output production as a percent of total world production is higher today than it was in 2000. So they're producing more today with one-third less the workforce.
Yeah, our productivity is really off the charts. And it's not just automation. A lot of it is people are working a lot harder and faster and longer for less money. The work has really intensified, and this is across the board. I think it's not just the auto industry. It's all industries. It's services. It's fast food workers and teachers and nurses. You know, nurses they're all working 12-hour shifts now. And they're exhausted, and they have they have too many patients to take care of. They're not able to do the kind of work that they wish that they wanted to do when they went into the profession. So I don't think it's limited to auto. I think what's happening at Chrysler is a struggle that will resonate with workers all across the board. I think a lot of people are looking at this and hoping that these rank-and-file workers will vote, demand that they get just reparations, that they
get a
slice of the pie equal to the work they're doing.
What are you going to predict? Are you going to vote the second one up or down? Second proposal up or down? Will the PR firm confuse people enough to get it passed?
I think they'll vote it down because it's so bad. And the UAW, you know, did give them more time to look at it. I think it was part of their part of the PR, you know. They wanted PR to have a chance to massage the social media. But the more you look at this, the worse it looks.
Mm-hmm.
The more shady it looks.
I see.
Well.
Well, hey, Greg, we're running out of time, but, you know, this is such a fascinating discussion. You're so informative. Can we have you back in the future here, future weeks, once they get a final settlement and we can pick apart what the final settlement and what it might be.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks a lot,
well,
Jack. I appreciate your time and attention and your audience as well.
Okay, well, this is very important. We'll see what's happening in two, 3 more weeks, maybe. I don't know. But worth revisiting. All right, Alternative Visions, Jack Rasmus. Please.